Well, please turn with me to our text in the book of Revelation as we continue to work our way through this very different and unique and wonderful book of the Bible. We'll be looking tonight at Revelation chapter 13, which is on page 1035 in the Pew Bible. 1035. Revelation 13, beginning in verse 1 and continuing to the end of the chapter. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? And who can fight against it?" And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. And it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive to captivity, he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Thus far, the reading of God's holy and inspired word, and all God's people said, Amen. 666, the number of the beast. I'm sure you're familiar with that. It's inspired all sorts of wild and fanciful notions, both among Christians and even in the broader culture sometimes. It's been suggested that the number of the beast is a matter of tattoos, or computer chips, maybe, that get planted in your forehead or barcodes or even birthmarks or the numerical value of the letters in a certain person's name. There's been all kinds of world leaders that have been calculated to be the beast by a certain kind of system of reckoning. Even Ronald Reagan, believe it or not, was considered to be a candidate by some. Well, all of these approaches to trying to interpret the number of the beast make the same basic mistake. And the mistake is this, and it's one that we should be familiar with by now in our study of Revelation. All of these approaches to interpreting this think that the number of the beast is to be understood literally, that this is in some sense a literal number. But as we have been noting all throughout this sermon series, the numbers in Revelation are symbolic. They're not literal. And as we'll see later on in tonight's sermon, there is a relatively straightforward explanation of the symbolic meaning of 666 that makes good sense in the context of the book of Revelation and really in the context of the Bible as a whole. Well, the two beasts in Revelation 13 represent the earthly powers that Satan, or the dragon, uses in order to accomplish his purposes in the world. The first beast, who's discussed in the first half of chapter 13, is the instrument that the dragon uses to exert his power. This first beast is, as it were, the dragon's arm. And the second beast is the instrument that the dragon uses to spread his ideology. It functions as the dragon's mind. Now, broadly speaking, both of these beasts can be seen as Antichrist figures, although the designation is really more directly applicable to the first beast, because the second beast is actually the false prophet who is mentioned later in the book of Revelation. It's the same figure. Now, it's true that these beasts are not called antichrists here, but they are antichrist figures because they do what antichrist does. They try to usurp what rightly belongs to Christ. I want to take a moment just to explain what the Bible means when it talks about antichrist. Now, that name itself only appears in two books of the Bible. It appears in 1 John and it appears in 2 John. But the idea is present in several other biblical books. It's found here in Revelation, especially in this first beast. And then it's also found in 2 Thessalonians. It's found in Daniel as well. But when we assemble all of the information that the Bible tells us about the Antichrist, we can come up with the following general picture. The Antichrist opposes the true worship of God and demands worship of itself. It's an imposter. It's a substitute. It's trying to set itself up in Christ's place and in God's place. And it leads in the persecution of God's people, and it seeks to advance Satan's agenda in the world through its power and through its false teaching. Now, the things that are said about Antichrist, especially in 1 John and 2 Thessalonians, indicate that while there will be an individual Antichrist figure at the end of history, there are also many forerunners of Antichrist throughout history. John says in 1 John, you have heard that Antichrist is coming. I tell you, many Antichrists are already here. And then Paul in 2 Thessalonians talks about the man of lawlessness who will come at the end of the age, but then he says that the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So in the words of theologian Anthony Hokema, though there is to be a climactic Antichrist at the end of time, there can be precursors or anticipations of the Antichrist before he appears. And I think it's important for us to keep that in mind as we study Revelation 13 tonight, because there are two errors that we would not want to slip into when we're studying this chapter. First of all, we would not want to do what many, many evangelicals do when they come to this passage. They think that this is all about the future. And it really doesn't have anything to do with today. It's only about that final Antichrist figure who will come at the end of history. It is about that, but it's not only about that. On the other end of the spectrum, we wouldn't want to make the mistake that some other interpreters would make in saying that, well, this is talking about Nero or some other Roman emperor. It's something that's already happened, something that was in the past. It does apply, perhaps, to some of those figures, but that's not all that it's talking about. There's a broader principle that applies at all times across history. So in this chapter, this is a very relevant chapter for us even today. We're given an eye-opening picture of forces that are at work in the world today. This text is therefore a lens that helps us understand the way things are and the things that are happening in the world around us. Well, I want to back up a little bit into chapter 12 before we get into chapter 13 here. But in the last part of chapter 12, we saw that the dragon, who is a symbolic depiction of Satan, was making war on the saints on earth after his defeat by Christ and his subsequent expulsion from the heavenly sphere. And we talked about that last week, how he, prior to Christ's accomplishment of redemption within history, Satan had access to the throne of God in order and was able to bring accusations against God's people. Even though God had a plan for how to deal with our sin, it hadn't actually been put into effect yet. It hadn't been accomplished yet. And so until Christ accomplished redemption within history, Satan was able to do what he does in the book of Job. He goes before God and he accuses Job. And he did the same with the people of Israel in the days of Zechariah in the form of the high priest Joshua in the prophecy of Zechariah. But now that Christ has accomplished that work, the dragon no longer can harass us in the heavenly realm. But he is permitted to do so in the earthly realm or the earthly sphere. Well, the sentence chapter 12 then ends with this sentence about talking about the dragon as he is thrown down to earth. It says, and he stood on the sand of the sea. Now that sentence is the link that connects the vision in chapter 12 to the vision in chapter 13. It tells us that the beast that rises up out of the sea is summoned by Satan, and he is given authority and power by Satan. Now, we've talked before about the symbolic significance of the sea in the book of Revelation. In the Bible, the sea sometimes represents chaos and the forces of evil, the things in this world that threaten the welfare of the people of God and that oppose the kingdom of God. And that's clearly the case here. In Isaiah 17 and then in Revelation 17, the waters are associated with nations that are raging against God and against his people. And this helps us to see that the first beast is symbolic of nations, governments, political powers, and social structures that inspire opposition to the church. So that's the broad meaning of this symbol. These are the world powers that oppose Christ's church. Now, like the dragon, this beast has seven heads and ten horns. Now, some interpreters will argue that the seven heads should be identified with seven successive Roman emperors. And the problem with taking that approach is that you have to figure out which Roman emperor you're going to decide, you're going to begin with and which one to end with. And it's really quite arbitrary. And so I don't think that that's the best way of trying to handle this. Again, the numbers 7 and 10 are symbolic in the book of Revelation. And really both of them are symbolic of completeness and fullness, a full set. So the basic point is that this beast takes different forms over the course of history, and that it is a force to be reckoned with. And this is underscored by John's description of the beast in verse 2, which is a composite of the four beasts that Daniel sees in his vision in Daniel 7. In Daniel 7, there are four beasts, and each of them have distinctive features. One is kind of like a leopard. One is like a lion. Well, here you have one beast, and it has all of those different features combined into one. Now, the reason why that's significant is because those four beasts in Daniel were symbolic of distinct kingdoms that persecuted God's people at successive points in biblical history. And generally, it's agreed that they are symbolic of Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, Greece, and then Rome. Now, at the same time, though, even though that is the most direct referent of those four beasts, even in Daniel's vision, those beasts have a symbolic significance that transcends those kingdoms and that represents all the persecution that world powers level against the church. And that explains why the four beasts of Daniel 7 are combined into one super beast here. It's because of that symbolism. Now, for John and his first century readers, this beast clearly represents Rome. That would be the most applicable candidate for who this beast is in that context. Yet there is a broader application throughout history. The beast from the sea is symbolic of all the world powers that Satan employs to oppose Christ's church. Now, John also says that this beast from the sea suffered what appeared to be a mortal wound on one of its heads. But then the wound was healed, and this resulted in the whole earth marveling as they followed the beast. Now, what is this talking about? Well, some interpreters will say, well, this refers, that mortal wound to one of the heads, this refers to Nero's suicide and the ensuing rumors that Nero wasn't really dead, that he was going to come back. Now, the problem with that theory is that it's just not plausible that John would put any stock in something so ludicrous, in something that was obviously false. Nero really did die. He's not coming back. He's gone. He killed himself. Now, it could be that this refers to Nero's death in another sense, in the sense that it did leave Rome in a state of instability for a period of time. There was about a period of 1 year where there was no clear emperor as different figures were vying for the throne. And finally, it was Vespasian who went back from Jerusalem. He was besieging Jerusalem, went back and secured the throne for himself and left Titus to take Jerusalem. That could be partially what's being talked about, but I think in general it's best to understand the beast's mortal wound by connecting it to the dragon back in chapter 12. Because the dragon, remember, is the source from which the beast derives its power and authority. They're connected to one another. To worship the beast is to worship the dragon. Now, we're told in verse 14 of this chapter that the beast's wound comes from a sword. Comes from a sword. Now, in Revelation, Christ is frequently described as bearing a sword, either the sword that comes out of his mouth or another sword that he uses to strike down his enemies later on in the book. I think that what's going on here is that this mortal wound is really connected with the idea that in Christ's death and resurrection, he dealt a fatal blow to Satan. He crushed the serpent's head. That was the end for Satan. And we saw that in the previous chapter, in chapter 12. And yet, Satan's still around, right? He's been defeated, but he's still wreaking havoc. He appears to have recovered from that blow in the sense that he's permitted to war against the church on earth. during this present age. He can't touch the church in heaven. He never could, of course, but he used to at least have access to God's throne where he could bring accusations against God's people. He can't do that anymore. But he is still active in the world. And he carries out this warfare against the church through these two beasts. So I think that the wound on one of the heads of the first beast doesn't refer just to one particular point in history, like the death of Nero, but it refers to the many downfalls that have been experienced by oppressive world powers that war against the church. Different powers oppose the church, persecute the church in different contexts and in different times, and eventually those powers go down. Eventually, they come crashing down. And then it appears at that point that maybe the beast is dead. People begin to get their hopes up, but then the beast eventually rises again in some other form. Now, another significant aspect of the beast's wound is that it's described in a manner that reminds us of Christ. Now, listen again to what it says. It says, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. Now, remember that when John turned and looked at the lion of the tribe of Judah, back in chapter 5, he said this, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain. Christ was slain and was raised, and the beast mimics this by appearing to do the same thing. And that shouldn't surprise us because he's a counterfeit Christ. Now, it's interesting, the beast also resembles the lamb in other ways, in multiple ways. Both have followers who receive a mark on their foreheads. Okay? Back in chapter 7, we learned about the mark that was placed upon all of the elect, the seal that was placed upon the elect. Here in this chapter, we're talked about the mark of the beast, the number of the beast. Both also have horns. Both have worldwide authority. Both receive worldwide worship. And the resemblance even extends to the Trinity itself. You have an unholy Trinity in the book of Revelation. The forces of evil are embodied in three figures: the dragon, the beast from the sea, who is the Antichrist in particular, and the beast from the earth, which is, as I said earlier, the false prophet. And then that unholy triumvirate is connected with another figure, the great prostitute, who's mentioned in chapter 17. And she stands as a parody of the bride of Christ. And so all of this is reflective of how the spirit of Antichrist seeks to cause people to direct the devotion and the worship that they owe to the one true God to itself. And that's exactly what we see happening in this chapter. You notice in verse 4, the people of the earth marvel at the beast and they say, "Who is like the beast? And who can fight against it?" Well, that statement resembles a number of Old Testament ascriptions of praise to God. Psalm 86, for example, says, "There is none like you among the gods, O Lord." So again, Satan and his Antichrist figures are counterfeits who try to set themselves up in God's place. Another notable feature of John's description of the first beast is his emphasis on the fact that the beast is given permission to do the things that he does. He is given a mouth that utters haughty and blasphemous words. He's allowed to exercise authority for a limited period of time, once again, 42 months. And remember, we've seen that number calculated in different ways at multiple points in the book of Revelation. 42 months, or 3.5 years, or 1,260 days, all the same period of time. And the emphasis there, remember, it's 3.5 is half of 7. It's a limited period of time. It's been cut short. And this is the symbolic period that's ordained for the church to endure tribulation on the earth as it bears witness to Christ. Now, one other thing that John says that the first beast is allowed to do is make war on the saints and even to conquer them. To conquer them. To conquer them on earth. Not in heaven, though. Now, Satan is the one who inspires and empowers the beast to do its work. But it's ultimately God who permits all of this to happen. And that's what's being conveyed by the repeated phrase, "It was allowed to do such and such." It's calling our attention to God's sovereignty over all of this. And when John speaks of how the beast fights against the saints, he describes the saints in a unique way. He describes us as those who dwell in heaven. Even though they're on earth here, obviously, because that's the only way that Satan can have any access to them. In the heavenly sphere, he can't touch us. Even though we do live on the earth, our dwelling place is in heaven. And this is how the book of Revelation distinguishes between the true identity of believers and the true identity of unbelievers. Even though believers still live on the earth, as long as we live in this life, our true and permanent dwelling place is in heaven. Unbelievers, however, are described in Revelation as those who dwell on the earth. And take note of what it is that is the determining factor when it comes to which group a person belongs to, whether you belong to those who dwell in heaven or those who dwell on earth. We see it in verse 8. "All who dwell on earth will worship the beast, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain." The book of life is a symbol for God's eternal decree of election, in which he appointed some to everlasting life. Those whose names have been written in that book will not succumb to the pressure to give their allegiance to the beast and to worship it. But the rest of humanity will worship the beast. And so we see that there is no neutral position here. People will either worship and serve the one true God, or they will worship and serve the forces of evil in one way or another. So the first half of the chapter ends with a statement that is derived from two passages in Jeremiah that describe Judah's captivity at the time of the Babylonian exile. We read it in verse 10. "If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain." The point that's being made by this is that persecution is inevitable for the church in this present age. In its original context, what those verses were saying is that, Judah, you're going to go into captivity. Judah, some of you are going to be slain by the sword. It is inevitable. It's going to happen. The same thing here is being said about the church. Though Christ has conquered Satan, Satan has been permitted to make war on the saints on earth for a time. He is even allowed to conquer the saints in the earthly sphere, though he cannot harm them in the heavenly sphere. And this is why the description of the first beast ends in the way that it does, with that sentence, "Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints." So that brings us to the second half of the chapter, beginning in verse 11. And where we find the second beast, the beast that rises out of the earth. Now, one reason why the first beast rose out of the sea is because its direct referent in the first century was Rome. And remember, John is writing to churches that were in Asia Minor. And when the Roman authorities came to Asia Minor, they would come over the sea. They would arise out of the sea. And so that makes sense for why the first beast rises out of the sea. The second beast rises out of the earth because it represents local forces. The local forces that promoted Rome and encouraged loyalty to it. Commentators have described this second beast as a sort of minister of propaganda for the first beast. And so really the broader symbolism here is this is false religion. These are false philosophies. And in John's day, the thing that this would have brought to mind was the imperial cult. And there are a variety of other ways in which this second beast or false prophet has operated throughout history. We can see its work in the various corruptions of Christianity that encourage compromise with and assimilation into the idolatrous world. Whenever the church does that, it is functioning like the false prophet of Revelation. And then in the broader culture, we can also see how institutions such as mass media and social media and popular culture and the technology industry, all of those things can be employed to promote worldly ideologies. And when they do, they're functioning like the false prophet. Well, as I've already been noting, this second beast is described later in Revelation as the false prophet. You can turn to chapter 16:13 and chapter 20:10 and see the reference to the false prophet alongside the beast and the dragon. Now, like the first beast or the Antichrist, the false prophet of Revelation is both a principle that's at work all throughout history and a figure who appears in some kind of final form or entity at the end of history. And another distinguishing feature of the false prophet that we see in John's description of it here is that it performs great signs in order to persuade people to worship the beast. And notice once again, by the way, that this is something that the false prophet is allowed to do, reminding us of God's ultimate control even over the forces of evil and the evil things that they do. God is sovereign. Now, one question that arises when we read about these signs that it's allowed to perform is, are these actual miracles or are they counterfeit ones? It may be a mixture. I think it's probably more along the lines of counterfeit signs. We certainly know that priests in the ancient world often faked miracles in order to impress people. We see, I think, that that's what's happening in the book of Exodus when Pharaoh's magicians tried to discredit Moses. Remember, they made their staffs turn into snakes, but then Moses' staff, of course, ate theirs. You know, that was wonderful, wasn't it? But in first century Asia Minor, pagan priests sometimes used ventriloquism and other tricks to make it appear that idolatrous images were alive. This was like, you know, the first century version of, you know, special effects and CGI and all that kind of stuff. And people were impressed. Most people didn't really believe it, but they liked the show, maybe. And this may be what is being alluded to by the description of the false prophet giving breath to the image of the beast so that it might speak. The basic idea here is that the false prophet works, whether it's through just charlatanism or whether it is through tapping into some kind of demonic powers, obviously, that God would be permitting to exert these kinds of influences, working through those things in order to persuade people that the beast is a force to be feared and obeyed. And then, of course, we're told that the false prophet uses the threat of execution to pressure people into worshiping the beast. And that, of course, brings to mind exactly what happened in the first couple of centuries of church history as the Romans pressured the early Christians to participate in the imperial cult, and many Christians were put to death because of their refusal to do so. Probably the most famous extra-biblical example would be Polycarp of Smyrna. Now, the final detail that's conveyed to us about this second beast is the one that garners the most attention, and that is that he causes people to be marked on their forehead or on their hand with the name or the number of the beast. Now, like the seal that was placed on the foreheads of the elect back in chapter 7, this is not a literal mark. It's a symbolic mark. It's kind of the symbolism is conveying the same idea as what's conveyed when a person places a brand on cattle. Or that's actually something that was done with slaves in parts of the ancient world. They were branded to signify ownership and devotion and loyalty. That's the point here. The people who receive the mark of the beast are people who are claimed by the beast, who are owned by the beast, and who give their devotion and their obedience and their loyalty and their worship to the beast. Those who have the mark of the beast on them belong to the world and to the dragon who controls it. And the fact that the mark is placed on their foreheads or on their hands is significant. It signifies that the devil controls their thoughts and their actions. And John also says that those who do not have this mark on them will not be allowed to buy and sell. In other words, a refusal to conform to the world and its ways will have a negative economic impact upon Christians, and especially at those times and contexts when the beast gains ascendancy over a particular culture. And you don't have to use your imagination very much to think about ways in which that could happen in our own culture. In fact, it's already begun to happen. What about people who are employed in baking wedding cakes, or taking pictures, photographs for weddings? If you don't bow your knee to the ideology of our age, then you won't be able to ply your trade. There's an economic impact there. So that's the point. It's not, don't make sure that nobody, tricks you into getting a tattoo on your forehead or something like that. That's not the point. Or that you get a microchip inserted under your skin against your knot. That's not the point. It's about loyalty. It's about where will your ultimate loyalty be, especially at those points when it's going to cost you. Maybe it'll cost you your livelihood, but where will your loyalty reside? Now, as for the symbolism of the number 666, you notice that it is called not just the number of the beast, but also the number of a man. The number of a man. Why would it be called that? Well, what day of the week was man created on? He was created on the sixth day of the week, wasn't he? Yeah. When we consider this number, 6, in light of the numerical symbolism that's such a key feature of the book of Revelation, we see that there's a problem with the number 6. There's a problem with it, symbolically. And the problem is it's not 7, right? Too bad for you, number 6. You're not number 7, right? 7 is the number of fullness. 6 falls short of 7. 7 is the number of completion and perfection. But 6, and especially a 6 that's repeated 3 times, well, that's the number of futility. I like the way that William Hendrickson puts it in his commentary. He says 666 is failure upon failure upon failure. And then our chapter ends with this statement. It says, "This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. What does John mean when he says that we need to calculate the number of the beast? Does it mean that only people who are really good at math will be able to avoid the snare of the beast? No, that's not what it means. This is not a command for people to employ all sorts of elaborate mathematical schemes to try to figure out the hidden identity of the figure behind the number 666. That's so arbitrary. Some people have tried to argue that it's the name Caesar Nero. If you take the Latin name Caesar Nero and you translate it into Greek and then you translate it into Hebrew, and you take the numerical equivalents of those Hebrew letters, which they do have numerical equivalents, and add them up, it comes to 666. It does work, except that you have to misspell the name Caesar to get it to do that. You know, so again, it's just, there's a lot of sleight of hand that goes on in those kinds of maneuvers. That's not the point. The point is simply this. We need to be watchful. We need to be watchful for the crafty and subtle ways in which the forces of evil try to insinuate their ideas into our hearts and into our minds. Now, the power that is wielded by the forces of Antichrist creates an atmosphere of fear, pressuring people into bowing down to evil forces. We're seeing it happen in our culture, especially with the whole LGBT agenda. People who have tons and tons of money, when they slip up, when they say something that's unorthodox according to the cultural dogma on these issues, what do you almost always see them doing the very next day? They're confessing their sin, and they're repenting of it, and they're saying, I promise I will educate myself, you know? So there is that dynamic. That's the first beast, the power of the first beast that creates this atmosphere of fear. We need to be aware of that. We don't need to fear that. What can they do to us? They could put us to death. That's the worst they could do to us. And also there's the work of the second beast or the false prophet. The deceptive strategies that are carried out by the false prophet, those cause people to think that the forces of Antichrist are worthy of their devotion. In one way or another, people actually do come to embrace these lies and they become devoted to them. And they actually think that they're righteous for doing so. Now, this calls for discernment and careful spiritual calculation on our part. If we're going to remain faithful to Christ in a world like this, we need to exercise discernment. For as the Apostle Peter warned, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. So let us make sure that we are sober-minded and that we are being watchful, that we might calculate the number of the beast. Amen.